program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
And you're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is going to be applicable for consumers of literally any piece of consumer technology that has solid-state hard drives in it, which is going to be your laptops, and also spinning technology, such as hard drives with spindles, which means literally any PC or laptop you've ever purchased. So it's going to be applicable to you, and also I have hot tips for the people in the audience who manage servers, and also a security tip for everyone, realizing then that it's actually quite rudimentary, apparently, to be able to take a speaker or some headphones and turn it into a listening device. Yes, that's correct. You heard me right. It is now completely rudimentary to take a headphone and turn it into a listening device. Some Israeli researchers have recently published on this fact. So let's get started. I'll start with the consumer stuff, and then we'll end up with the server items. So with regards to solid-state hard drives and spindled hard drives, I think some folks have had quite a significant misconception over the years. There's been the whole topic of, yes, if you have spindled hard drives, then you do need to defragment them. But there has been a misconception about solid-state hard drives stating that, well, you don't need to defragment them, and actually doing so causes more harm. Well, I have always thought that that was an incorrect assertion. And I recently saw a publication by Howard Butler, who is one of the top engineers at Conducive, and Conducive is the world leader for disk defragmentation software. And I can absolutely affirm to you of the effectiveness of their DiskKeeper products. I have personally experienced many servers literally being saved to where their performance was so bad that the individual was going to replace, or the organization was going to replace, that server. And I said, no, you know, let's put DiskKeeper server on it, and then whoosh, the problems go away. Of course, with any piece of software, you need to stay up to date on it. And I've experienced exactly the same thing happening on consumer devices, such as your laptop or your desktop computer. And a simple license of DiskKeeper will solve tons of problems, and I'm going to explain why. So what you may not know is that for less than $40, you can go onto Conducive's website and buy the home pack that covers three installations. So you get three installations of DiskKeeper 16 Home Edition for less than $40. Clearly, that's a good deal. So I do strongly recommend, if you've got some home computers, that you put DiskKeeper 16 on there. So let's talk about why these misconceptions that people have about SSDs and solid-state hard drives and defragmentation in general, why their misconceptions are just completely wrong. So their misconceptions, they are talking about how, well, so their perception is that a solid-state hard drive has a theoretical seek time to find data on it that is theoretically the same regardless of whether the file is fragmented or not. And, you know, just intuitively, you don't even have to be a computer person to figure this out. If you walked up to a bookshelf in a library and you wanted to retrieve a book, except chunks of that book existed in 12 places, and you now had to go locate those 12 pieces of the book, then you had to reassemble the book, and then you had to read the book, you know, like look up the table of contents and then read it. And then when you're done, tear that book back up and put it back in those 12 places, or maybe in this case, because maybe you added some pages to the book, like you were saving to your Excel file, it now is in 15 places. So that is the damage that fragmentation on any storage device causes. And that fragmentation just inherently causes issues with retrieval and savings being, you know, when I say retrieval, you're retrieving the file, and saving being you're saving the file or the system is saving the file. That is just inherently going to be a slow process. It's got to be slower than if the file was all in one single contiguous chunk. So when you went to the bookshelf, oh, there's my book, and it's all in one piece, and I can open it up, and I can insert some more pages, and then, of course, I can put it back on the bookshelf in one contiguous chunk. So that is just obviously and intuitively more efficient than an inefficient process of ripping stuff up and manually reassembling it after you've located the 12 pieces. So then you have to ask the question, well, why does this fragmentation happen at all? And some people have said, well, it's less of an issue in the newer operating systems. And that's not really the case. The fact exists that the Windows file storage system, so way, 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 way back in the day, it was called FAT, file allocation table. Then it was FAT32, which is 32-bit file allocation table. And nobody uses that anymore except on maybe USB flash drives because you can't actually do permissions on FAT or FAT32. So now what's used is NTFS. So that's the file system that's sitting on top of a partition methodology, and that could be MBR, GPT, and all that really is irrelevant. What's relevant is the fact that as soon as you say, I want to have a Windows computer, and I want to be able to control permissions on the operating system, or excuse me, on the file and folder level, so on the C drive and the D drive and the system partition and these sorts of things. As soon as you actually say, I want to have a secure computer, then you're going to have NTFS. And some systems default to a 4K block size, and some systems default to a 64K block size. And so that's all fine and dandy. And I'm not going to debate here the horse apiece, because there's some cases where 64 is the best answer and some cases where 4K is the best answer. And you can't, the one thing I will tell you is you can't go change it after the fact of whatever it's done. The guidance that I can give you is just whatever the default is. I mean, unless you're some sort of serious, very serious technical expert, just leave the default alone with regards to the block size for NTFS. Okay, so if 64K is the default block size, leave it alone. You know, in general, I would say don't think you're smarter than the people who designed the operating system, okay? Because that's probably not going to be the case for the majority of the people on this planet. So it's best to just, in some cases, take defaults. Okay, so now then why does this fragmentation occur? Well, it occurs simply because of the inherent way that NTFS file driver, so the actual driver that writes the files between the operating system and the physical hardware, because of the way that that works, and because of the way that that whole system exists, and without going into all that technical detail, it is inherently non-optimized. Now, you could argue, well, okay, why doesn't Microsoft fix that? Well, that's a good question. And I have a feeling that it has something to do with, I mean, I haven't seen any official documentation on it. You know, they don't have like a blog posting where they're saying, well, we're not going to fix the NTFS file writer driver because. But I suspect it's because there has to be, it is the way that it is because it has to be that way. Probably. I'm speculating at this point. And if they changed it, it would probably break a whole lot of things. And it would probably have a huge problem with backward compatibility. Now, does that mean in the year 2022 they won't change it? No, that doesn't necessarily mean that in the year 2022 they won't change it, because they've certainly already changed things. But there's, I mean, for example, we have GPT disk now when we never used to have GPT. We only used to have MBR. So there is certainly the opportunity to fix this in the future, but for the time being, they have to maintain backward compatibility. And so what you end up with is a necessity of having a product like Diskkeeper. Now, we already talked about the pricing on your PCs at home is insanely cheap, so there's just really no reason to not do it. And then with regards to volume for workstations in an office environment, I think you could make the argument that you might really want to pay for that software licensing for maybe your really high productivity workers like your CFO, who's just hammering away at their computer all day, and they're significant power users, and anything that leads to a non-optimized slower computer is actually costing the company money. So you can be selective about what machines you deploy this to. But in the case of servers, I would argue that every single server should have Diskkeeper server on it, because I've seen it be so dramatically improving the performance of the servers. I mean, to the point where it's, this server is going to die, and then, oh, hey, it works again. So it's literally that dramatic. And let's say you could cover on a per server basis for $500 to $600, something like that in terms of pricing. Then you're going to pay an annual renewal fee on that so that you can maintain the software subscription, so that you can constantly always have the latest and greatest version of the software, which I did mention in the beginning was a requirement. You do not want to be using old software like this. So let's move on to the Windows Server Channel topic. Well, actually, before I do that, talk more about this whole topic of the turning headphones into listening devices. So these Israeli researchers, they basically figured out how to take a codec, and a codec is a piece, it's like a driver. It's almost like a driver, and it's a piece of software that interacts between hardware and the operating system. And so they figured out how to hack that codec and turn a headphone into a listening device. So instead of having the codec function as a sound output, it reprogrammed it to be a sound input. And from a physics perspective, the physics of a headphone is really just, you know, it's like a tympanic vibration, just the same as a microphone pickup. I mean, yes, you could definitely argue that the various technologies are optimized one way or the other, absolutely. But it is absolutely possible to take just about every headphone out there and turn it into a listening device, which is very unexpected to most people, I would say. And so what, there really is no mitigation for this problem, because that's how physics exists. And if you are going to be getting malware on your computer that's going to hack the codec, then you're already not taking all of the other due diligence approaches that you need to be taking advantage of. And so when I say there isn't a specific risk mitigation technique for this, it's, well, no, what are you supposed to do? You know, unplug everything? I mean, is that your approach? I mean, I suppose you could do that. I suppose you could say, look, I'm just going to unplug everything. However, I would be very, I would caution you to realize that most PCs actually have, I mean, I'm talking like a tower or a desktop computer. Most of them have what's called an internal speaker. You may not realize this, but it does. It has an internal speaker in many cases. And so that is utilized to issue beep codes if the computer needs to send you beep codes for error diagnostics or something like that. And so you can't go onto the motherboard and disconnect that without really working at it. And then the question is, do you really want to disconnect that? Because if the computer needs to give you diagnostic beep codes, you probably want to know about that. You don't want to be oblivious to beeps that should be occurring, because if it's giving you beep codes, then that's something you definitely need to take action on. So in terms of mitigation, it's strictly just do all the security techniques that we've covered on this show tons of times. and just keep the malware off of your computer, keep the codec on your computer from getting hacked. Okay, it's basically like that. Now, onto the server stuff. Microsoft has what's called the Windows Server Channel, and I'm just going to publish a link to it. And if you are somebody who is managing one server or many servers, definitely go out there and check that out. It's free training. It's all about Windows Server 2016 and its new features. And these are really well-done videos that are demos and concept discussions, etc. And it's really going to help you learn what you need to know about the new server operating system. And then there's another link I'm publishing, which is understanding the new security features in Windows Server 2016. I think Microsoft is really doing as best as they can on all fronts, not only the cloud front, but also the on-premise front, to bake in security by default, as well as enable the what has historically been accessible only to enterprise, to make those techniques such as authentication silos or just-in-time security or just-in-time credentials escalation, really baking those things in and making those techniques accessible to even the small and medium business space, which, as I said previously, a lot of those techniques were really only accessible to large enterprise, which I would characterize as organizations with 10,000 or more computers. Because 10,000 or more computers means you have 8 full-time, you know, master Windows Server engineers who are going to be able to sit around and really hardcore focus on how do they do authentication silos and really the advanced security isolation techniques, okay? And things like local administrator password solution. Well, now local administrator password solution is implementable quite not as easy as some things, but it's definitely accessible. And for even an organization that had 12 computers, I would absolutely recommend it. If you've only got 3 computers, I don't think it's worth putting it in. Then another really fantastic development is the publication of some scripts. And again, I'm going to have the link for this posted. The fantastic scripts that are some of the easiest scripts that I have seen to use in a super, super long time. I mean, you could be a basic level Windows Server Active Directory admin. I mean, really somebody that does not have a lot of experience or expertise and be very successful with these scripts. So I'm going to publish the link to these. And these are about changing the password on the KRBTGT accounts. Now, what in the world is that? Well, a KRBTGT account has to do with the Kerberos ticket granting tickets that are part of the authentication process between Active Directory and domain-joined devices. So when you log on to your Windows domain-joined computer, you get a Kerberos ticket-granting ticket. And these KRBTGT accounts are always disabled, but it's very important that you change the passwords on these frequently, and you cannot just go in and manually do it. I mean, no good comes from that. So it's really fantastic that Microsoft has published these scripts to make it so that you could do that yourself. And effectively what it's doing is it really gives you some fantastic output. It shows you when was the last time that the password for the KRBTGT accounts in your environment has been changed. So that's awesome from a security auditing perspective. The script has 3 modes. One is like a survey mode, and then another is feasibility of, if I do this, is it going to work? So that's like the testing. So one's a survey mode, the other mode is a testing mode, and then the third mode is the actual execution mode. So in my view, boy, you really can't break anything by doing this. Because if you follow the instructions where you do the survey mode first and then you do the testing mode, if you find problems that are demonstrated through the testing mode, and then of course if you go and action it without resolving those, if you tell it to change the password without resolving those error messages, well then, you know, you just caused problems yourself. But in the testing mode, if you find problems, well then you go fix them, then you run testing mode again, and it shows clean, then go ahead and change that. Something you may not know is that the KRB TGT accounts are, there's typically going to be one for every domain controller, and especially extras for read-only domain controllers. So if you're in an environment where you have no read-only domain controllers, you may have a very small number of KRB TGT accounts, which is good. Read-only domain controllers, I don't recommend them at all for organizations with less than 30 domain controllers, because there are just so many issues with having read-only domain controllers, and generally the people managing those infrastructures don't really understand what those issues and implications of having a read-only domain controller is. I mean, they think it's increasing security, and oftentimes it's causing more problems than it's worth, and I've ended up taking them out of a lot of environments because of those problems. So I'm going to post that link, and again, I strongly encourage you, if you have a server that you are managing, to go out there and get that, and then, you know, download it and execute it, okay? I want to talk about PoisonTap next, and the problem with PoisonTap really cannot be exaggerated. PoisonTap is another piece of malware. It's technically a USB device with a bunch of hack code on it that has been developed by Sami Kamkar, who I would definitely describe as a security genius. And he's just a really interesting guy. He keeps taking these Raspberry Pis and loading them with truly heinous technology, and doing it in a way that really is educational. So he's doing it with a lot of very good intent, and the way that he does it is very good. He exposes massive problems that people need to be aware of. So PoisonTap is just the second recent example of why you cannot leave your computer booted up and at the lock screen. So people think that they are getting secure with their physical computer by encrypting their hard drive and having like secure, well, okay, let me differentiate there. People think that they're getting security just by encrypting their hard drive. Now, unless you have actually configured a BIOS administrative password, and which means that you can't change the BIOS settings without the admin password, and that you've specified that the hard drive is the first boot mechanism, and of course, unless you have the admin code to change that, then you can't, right? And you have to have actually specified a boot password for the encrypted hard drive. Now, if you haven't really done all of that, then you're not really mitigating very many risks associated with the issues here through simply disk encryption. So it's important that if you're actually going to do disk encryption and you're going to rely upon it to deliver a particular security value, then do it correctly. And this involves either group policy objects or specification of local policy on a Windows computer with custom policy settings prior to enabling disk encryption with BitLocker. Now, if you're using something like a SecureStar product, then, you know, the rules are different. SecureStar is going to require you to have a boot password. I mean, you literally cannot do stupid disk encryption with SecureStar. So SecureStar is really a great product. They have a DCPP, Drive Crypt Plus Pack. If you're super paranoid and you travel internationally, then they have an awesome product that will in DCPP that allows you to create what's called a duress operating system. Well, there's a duress code, which will literally do like a hard kill on everything. But then there's the duress operating system, which it will effectively boot up a fake operating system, because many times you have to go through an international checkpoint or a checkpoint, whatever, and they will say, well, boot up your computer, you know. And you can either decide you're going to get into a war with Customs and Border Patrol that I guarantee you, you're not going to come out unscathed from, regardless of whether you win in the long run. You will be scathed. So, you know, obfuscation is a better approach at that point, and just utilize some technology to give them a different operating system than the one that you perhaps rely upon. The other technique you could use is just to carry a device that really you're not carrying anything interesting on it at all, and show them the real thing, but then really don't utilize that for anything other than a straight VPN tunnel back to whatever your secure resources are that you're then going to be remote controlling. So there's a variety of techniques you can utilize there with that. So back to the whole poison tap thing and physical access. I said that you really cannot anymore leave your computer booted up and at the lock screen and leave it unattended where other humans could get at it. So, what this means is the machine needs to be shut down all the way if you are not providing physical security with your bodily presence to that device. If it is locked up in your home and you feel like you're providing physical security to it in that way, and there's no possible way that a bad guy would be able to break into your house and do poison tap on your computer, then okay. But I guess my perspective is that unless you've got a hardened data center, which is basically a big pile of steel of steel and concrete with a secured hardened steel reinforced door, which most people are not going to have in their homes, then you should shut that computer down. Now, there are going to be times when you need to leave the computer on for maintenance. And so do that overnight on nights when you're there. But if you're going to go to work and you're going to be gone for 8 to 10 hours, I don't see why that computer should be booted up. I really don't. Because if a bad guy gets into your house and they put poison tap in there or any of the other tools that function like poison tap, you've just lost your entire computer, all your credentials, and all the stuff that's on it. And I'm not exaggerating. This technology has actually been around for a while. It's just that lately I've seen some increased openness with regards to the publication of this code and how accessible it is now. And now that it is so accessible, believe me, the bad guys have full instruction manuals to get this stuff, and it is highly probable that a 12-year-old with a little bit of time on the internet and a Raspberry Pi Zero, which they can get for less than $50, is going to have the capabilities to destroy your life if you decide to leave your computer booted up, unencrypted, because of course when it's booted up, it's decrypted, and even at the lock screen. So, and if you're leaving that computer unattended, well, then you can basically kiss your data goodbye. So I strongly suggest, if you're going to have your computer in an unattended mode and you're not in the house to specifically babysit it and make sure nobody's touching it, then shut it down. Well, that's it for today's show, and I hope you've enjoyed it. As always, feel free to send me feedback.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern